her lips pressed together, her fists clenched. Her lizard demon acquired a ruff and raised it slowly around his neck.
Oh, very well. But we go through quickly and in complete silence. And you do exactly what I say at once. You understand?
She nodded and patted her pocket yet again to check the medicine. Will made a small opening, low down, looked through and enlarged it swiftly, getting through in a moment on hands and knees. Amma was right behind him, and altogether the window was open for less than 10 seconds. They crouched on the cave floor behind a large rock, with the bird-formed Balthamos beside them, their eyes taking some moments to adjust from the moon-drenched brilliance of the other world. Inside the cave it was much darker, and much more full of sound, mostly the wind in the trees, but below that was another sound, too. It was the roar of a Zeppelin's engine, and it wasn't far away. With a knife in his right hand, Will balanced himself carefully and looked around. Amma was doing the same, and her owl-eyed demon was peering this way and that, but Lyra was not at this end of the cave. There was no doubt about it. Will raised his head over the rock and took a long, steady look down towards the entrance, where Mrs. Coulter and her demon lay deep in sleep. And then his heart sank. There lay Lyra, stretched out in the depths of her sleep, right next to Mrs. Coulter. Their outlines had merged in the darkness. No wonder he hadn't seen her. Will touched Amma's hand and pointed.
We'll just have to do it very carefully.
Something was happening outside. The roar of the Zeppelins was now much louder than the wind in the trees, and lights were moving about too, shining down through the branches from above. The quicker they got Lyra out, the better, and that meant darting down there now before Mrs. Coulter woke up, cutting through, pulling her to safety, and closing again. He whispered that to Amma. She nodded. Then, as he was about to move, Mrs. Coulter woke up. She stirred and said something, and instantly the golden monkey sprang to his feet. Will could see his silhouette in the cave mouth, crouching, attentive, and then Mrs. Coulter herself sat up, shading her eyes against the light outside. Will's left hand was tight around Amma's wrist. Mrs. Coulter got up, fully dressed, lithe, alert, not at all as if she'd just been asleep. Perhaps she'd been awake all the time. She and the golden monkey were crouching inside the cave mouth, watching and listening, as the light from the Zeppelins swung from side to side above the treetops and the engines roared, and shouts, male voices warning or calling orders, made it clear that they should move fast, very fast. Will squeezed Amma's wrist and darted forward, watching the ground in case he stumbled, running fast and low. Then he was at Lyra's side, and she was deep asleep, pantalaimon around her neck. And then Will held up the knife and felt carefully, and a second later there would have been an opening to pull Lyra through into safety. But he looked up. He looked at Mrs. Coulter. She had turned around silently, and the glare from the sky reflected off the damp cave wall, hit her face, and for a moment it wasn't her face at all. It was his own mother's face, reproaching him, and his heart quailed from sorrow. And then as he thrust with the knife, his mind left the point, and with a wrench and a crack, the knife fell in pieces to the ground. It was broken. Now he couldn't cut his way out at all. He said to Amma,
"Wake her up. Do it now."
Then he stood up, ready to fight. He'd strangle that monkey first. He was tensed to meet its leap, and he found he still had the hilt of the knife in his hand. At least he could use it to hit with. But there was no attack, either from the golden monkey or from Mrs. Coulter. She simply moved a little to let the light from outside show the pistol in her hand. In doing so, she let some of the light shine on what Amma was doing. She was sprinkling a powder on Lyra's upper lip and watching as Lyra breathed in, helping it into her nostrils by using her own demon's tail as a brush. Will heard a change in the sounds from outside. There was another note now, as well as the roar of the Zeppelins. It sounded familiar, like an intrusion from his own world, and then he recognized the clatter of a helicopter. Then there was another and another, and more light swept across the ever-moving trees outside in a brilliant green scatter of radiance. Mrs. Coulter turned briefly as the new sound came to her, but too briefly for Will to jump and seize the gun. As for the monkey demon, he glared at Will without blinking, crouched ready to spring. Lyra was moving and murmuring. Will bent down and squeezed her hand, and the other demon nudged Pantalaimon, lifting his heavy head, whispering to him. Outside there was a shout, and a man fell out of the sky, to land with a sickening crash not 5 yards from the entrance to the cave. Mrs. Coulter didn't flinch. She looked at him coolly and turned back to Will. A moment later there came a crack of rifle fire from above, and a second after that a storm of shooting broke out, and the sky was full of explosions, of the crackle of flame, of bursts of gunfire. Lyra was struggling up into consciousness, gasping, sighing, moaning, pushing herself up only to fall back weakly. And Pantalaimon was yawning, stretching, snapping at the other demon, flopping clumsily to one side as his muscles failed to act. As for Will, he was searching the cave floor with the utmost care for the pieces of the broken knife. No time to wonder how it had happened, or whether it could be mended, but he was the knife-bearer, and he had to gather it up safely. As he found each piece, he lifted it carefully, every nerve in his body aware of his missing fingers, and slipped it into the sheath. He could see the pieces quite easily because the metal caught the gleam from outside, seven of them, the smallest being the point itself. He picked them all up and then turned back to try and make sense of the fight outside. Somewhere above the trees, the Zeppelins were hovering and men were sliding down ropes, but the wind made it difficult for the pilots to hold the aircraft steady. Meanwhile, the first gyropters had arrived above the cliff. There was only room for them to land one at a time, and then the African riflemen had to make their way down the rock face. It was one of them who had been picked off by a lucky shot from the swaying Zeppelins. By this time, both sides had landed some troops. Some had been killed between the sky and the ground. Several more were wounded and lay on the cliff or among the trees. But neither force had yet reached the cave, and still the power inside it lay with Mrs. Coulter. Will said above the noise,
"What are you going to do?"
"Hold you captive."
"What? As hostages? Why should they take any notice of that? They want to kill us all anyway."
"One force does, certainly, but I'm not sure about the other. We must hope the Africans win."
She sounded happy, and in the glare from outside, Will saw her face full of joy and life and energy.
"You broke the knife."
"No, I didn't. I wanted it whole so we could get away. You were the one who broke it."
Lyra's voice came urgently.
"Will? Is that Will?"
"Lyra."
He knelt quickly beside her. Alma was helping her sit up.
"What's happening? Where are we? Oh, Will, I had this dream."
"We're in a cave. Don't move too fast. You'll get dizzy. Just take it carefully. Find your strength. You've been asleep for days and days."
Her eyes were still heavy and she was racked by deep yawns, but she was desperate to be awake, and he helped her up, putting her arm over his shoulder and taking much of her weight. Alma watched timidly, for now that the strange girl was awake, she was nervous of her. Will breathed in the scent of Lyra's sleepy body with a happy satisfaction. She was here. She was real. They sat on a rock. Lyra held his hand and rubbed her eyes.
"What's happening, Will?"
"Alma here got some powder to wake you up."
Lyra turned to the girl, seeing her for the first time, and put her hand on Alma's shoulder in thanks.
"I got here as soon as I could. But some soldiers did too. I don't know who they are. We'll get out as soon as we can."
Outside, the noise and confusion were reaching a height. One of the gyropters had taken a fusillade from a Zeppelin's machine gun while the riflemen were jumping out on the clifftop, and it burst into flames, not only killing the crew but also preventing the remaining gyropters from landing. Another Zeppelin, meanwhile, had found a clear space further down the valley, and the crossbowmen who disembarked from it were now running up the path to reinforce those already in action. Mrs. Coulter was following as much as she could see from the cave mouth, and now she raised her pistol, supporting it with both hands, and took careful aim before firing. Will saw the flash from the muzzle, but heard nothing over the explosions and gunfire from outside. "If she does that again," he thought, "I'll rush and knock her over." And he turned to whisper that to Balthamos. But the angel was nowhere near. Instead, Will saw with dismay, he was cowering against the wall of the cave, back in his angel form, trembling and whimpering.
"Balthamos! Come on, they can't hurt you! And you have to help us! You can fight, you know that. You're not a coward, and we need you."
But before the angel could reply, something else happened. Mrs. Coulter cried out and reached down to her ankle, and simultaneously the golden monkey snatched at something in midair with a snarl of glee. A voice, a woman's voice, but somehow minute, came from the thing in the monkey's paw.
"Tialis! Oh, Tialis!"
It was a tiny woman, no bigger than Lyra's hand, and the monkey was already pulling and pulling at one of her arms so that she cried out in pain. Alma knew he wouldn't stop till he'd torn it off, but Will leapt forward as he saw the pistol fall from Mrs. Coulter's hand. And he caught the gun, but then Mrs. Coulter fell still, and Will became aware of a strange stalemate. The golden monkey and Mrs. Coulter were both utterly motionless. Her face was distorted with pain and fury, but she dared not move, because standing on her shoulder was a tiny man with his heel pressed against her neck, his hands entwined in her hair. And Will, through his astonishment, saw on that heel a glistening horny spur and knew what had caused her to cry out a moment before. He must have stung her ankle. But the little man couldn't hurt Mrs. Coulter any more because of the danger his partner was in at the hands of the monkey. And the monkey couldn't harm her in case the little man dug his poison spur into Mrs. Coulter's jugular vein. None of them could move. Breathing deeply and swallowing hard to govern the pain, Mrs. Coulter turned her tear-dashed eyes to Will.
So, Master Will, what do you think we should do now?
Chapter 13. Tialis and Salmakia.
Frowning, frowning night, o'er this desert bright, let thy moon arise while I close my eyes. William Blake.
Holding the heavy gun, Will swept his hand sideways and knocked the golden monkey off his perch, stunning him so that Mrs. Coulter groaned aloud, and the monkey's paw relaxed enough to let the tiny woman struggle free. In a moment she leapt up to the rocks, and the man sprang away from Mrs. Coulter, both of them moving as quickly as grasshoppers. The three children had no time to be astonished. The man was concerned. He felt his companion's shoulder and arm tenderly, and embraced her swiftly before calling to Will.
You, boy, have you got the knife?
Of course I have,
said Will. If they didn't know it was broken, he wasn't going to tell them.
You and the girl will have to follow us. Who is the other child?
Arma, from the village.
Tell her to return there. Move now, before the Swiss come.
Will didn't hesitate. Whatever these two intended, he and Lyra could still get away through the window he'd opened behind the bush on the path below. So he helped her up and watched curiously as the two small figures leapt on... What? Birds? No, dragonflies, as large as seagulls which had been waiting in the darkness. Then they darted forward to the cave mouth where Mrs. Coulter lay. She was half stunned with pain and drowsy from the Chevalier's sting, but she reached up as they went past her and cried,
Lyra! Lyra, my daughter! My dear one, Lyra! Don't go! Don't go!
Lyra looked down at her, anguished, but then she stepped over her mother's body and loosened Mrs. Coulter's feeble clutch from her ankle. The woman was sobbing now. Will saw the tears glistening on her cheeks. Crouching just beside the cave mouth, the three children waited until there was a brief pause in the shooting, and then followed the dragonflies as they darted down the path. The light had changed. As well as the cold and barrack gleam from the Zeppelin's floodlights, there was the leaping orange of flames. Will looked back once. In the glare, Mrs. Coulter's face was a mask of tragic passion, and her demon clung piteously to her as she knelt and held out her arms, crying,
Lyra! Lyra, my love! My heart's treasure, my little child! My only one! Oh, Lyra! Lyra, don't go! Don't leave me! My darling daughter... You're tearing my heart!
And a great and furious sob shook Lyra herself, for after all, Mrs. Coulter was the only mother she would ever have, and Will saw a cascade of tears run down the girl's cheeks. But he had to be ruthless. He pulled at Lyra's hand, and as the dragonfly rider darted close to his head, urging them to hurry, he led her at a crouching run down the path and away from the cave. In Will's left hand, bleeding again from the blow he'd landed on the monkey, was Mrs. Coulter's pistol.
Make for the top of the cliff,
said the dragonfly rider,
and give yourself up to the Africans. They're your best hope.
Mindful of those sharp spurs, Will said nothing, though he hadn't the least intention of obeying. There was only one place he was making for, and that was the window behind the bush. So he kept his head low and ran fast, and Lyra and Arma ran behind him.
Halt!
There was a man, three men, blocking the path ahead, uniformed. White men with crossbows and snarling wolf-dog demons, the Swiss Guard.
Yorick!
Cried Will at once.
Yorick Birnison!
He could hear the bear crashing and snarling not far away, and hear the screams and cries of the soldiers unlucky enough to meet him. But someone else came from nowhere to help them. Balthamos, in a blur of desperation, hurled himself between the children and the soldiers. The men fell back amazed as this apparition shimmered into being in front of them. But they were trained warriors, and a moment later their demons leapt at the angel, savage teeth flashing white in the gloom, and Balthamos flinched. He cried out in fear and shame, and shrank back. Then he sprang upwards, beating his wings hard. Will watched in dismay as the figure of his guide and friend soared up to vanish out of sight among the treetops. Lyra was following it all with still dazed eyes. It had taken no more than 2 or 3 seconds, but it was enough for the Swiss to regroup, and now their leader was raising his crossbow, and Will had no choice. He swung up the pistol and clamped his right hand to the butt and pulled the trigger, and the blast shook his bones, but the bullet found the man's heart. The soldier fell back as if he'd been kicked by a horse. Simultaneously, the two little spies launched themselves at the other two, leaping from the dragonflies at their victims before Will could blink. The woman found a neck, the man a wrist, and each made a quick backward stab with a heel. A choking, anguished gasp, and the two Swiss died, their demons vanishing in mid-howl. Will leapt over the bodies, and Lyra went with him, running hard and fast with Pantalaimon racing wildcat formed at their heels. "Where's Amma?" Will thought, and he saw her in the same moment dodging down a different path. "Now she'll be safe," he thought, and a second later he saw the pale gleam of the window deep behind the bushes. He seized Lyra's arm and pulled her towards it. Their faces were scratched, their clothes were snagged, their ankles twisted on roots and rocks, but they found the window and tumbled through into the other world, onto the bone-white rocks under the glaring moon, where only the scraping of the insects broke the immense silence. And the first thing Will did was to hold his stomach and retch, heaving and heaving with a mortal horror. That was 2 men now that he'd killed, not to mention the youth in the Tower of the Angels. Will did not want this. His body revolted at what his instinct had made him do, and the result was a dry, sour, agonizing spell of kneeling and vomiting until his stomach and his heart were empty. Lyra watched helpless nearby, nursing Pan, rocking him against her breast. Will finally recovered a little and looked around, and at once he saw that they weren't alone in this world, because the little spies were there, too, with their packs laid on the ground nearby. Their dragonflies were skimming over the rocks, snapping up moths. The man was massaging the shoulder of the woman, and both of them looked at the children sternly. Their eyes were so bright and their features so distinct that there was no doubt about their feelings, and Will knew they were a formidable pair, whoever they were. He said to Lyra,
"The alethiometer's in my rucksack. There."
"Oh, Will, I did so hope you'd find it. Whatever happened? Did you find your father? Oh, and my dream, Will. It's too much to believe what we've got to do. Oh, I don't even think of it. And it's safe. You brought it all this way safe for me."
The words tumbled out of her so urgently that even she didn't expect answers. She turned the alethiometer over and over, her fingers stroking the heavy gold and the smooth crystal and the knurled wheels they knew so well. Will thought, "It'll tell us how to mend the knife." But he said first,
"Are you all right? Are you hungry or thirsty?"
"I don't know. Yeah, but not too much. Anyway..."
"We should move away from this window, just in case they find it and come through."
"Yes, that's true,"
she said, and they moved up the slope, Will carrying his rucksack and Lyra happily carrying the little bag she kept the alethiometer in. Out of the corner of his eye, Will saw the 2 small spies following, but they kept their distance and made no threat. Over the brow of the rise there was a ledge of rock that offered a narrow shelter, and they sat beneath it, having carefully checked it for snakes, and shared some dried fruit and some water from Will's bottle.
"The knife's broken. I don't know how it happened. Mrs. Coulter did something, or said something, and I thought of my mother, and that made the knife twist, or catch, or... I don't know what happened. But we're stuck till we can get it mended. I didn't want those 2 little people to know, because while they think I can still use it, I've got the upper hand. I thought you could ask the alethiometer, maybe, and..."
Yeah, I will."
She had the golden instrument out in a moment, and moved into the moonlight so she could see the dial clearly. Looping back the hair behind her ears, just as Will had seen her mother do, she began to turn the wheels in the old familiar way, and Pantalaimon, mouse-formed now, sat on her knee. She had hardly started before she gave a little gasp of excitement, and she looked up at Will with shining eyes as the needle swung. But it hadn't finished yet, and she looked back, frowning, until the instrument fell still. She put it away, saying,
"Yorick, is he nearby, Will? I thought I heard you call him, but then I thought I was just wishing. Is he really?"
"Yes. Could he mend the knife? Is that what the alethiometer said?"
"Oh, he can do anything with metal, Will. Not only armor, he can make little delicate things as well."
She told him about the small tin box Yorick had made for her to shut the spy fly in.
"But he?
Close by. He would have come when I called, but obviously he was fighting. And Balthamus! Oh, he must have been so frightened.
Who?
He explained briefly, feeling his cheeks warm with the shame that the angel must be feeling.
But I'll tell you more about him later. It's so strange. He told me so many things, and I think I understand them too.
He ran his hands through his hair and rubbed his eyes.
You've got to tell me everything. Everything you did since she caught me. Oh, Will, you ain't still bleeding. Your poor hand.
No. My father cured it. I just opened it up when I hit the golden monkey. But it's better now. He gave me some ointment that he'd made.
You found your father?
That's right. On the mountain, that night.
He let her clean his wound and put on some fresh ointment from the little horn box, while he told her some of what had happened. The fight with the stranger. The revelation that came to them both a second before the witch's arrow struck home. His meeting with the angels. His journey to the cave. And his meeting with Yorick.
All that happening, and I was asleep. Do you know, I think she was kind to me, Will. I think she was. I don't think she ever wanted to hurt me. She did such bad things, but...
She rubbed her eyes.
Oh, but my dream, Will. I can't tell you how strange it was. It was like when I read the alethiometer. All that clearness and understanding going so deep, you can't see the bottom. Clear all the way down. It was... Remember I told you about my friend Roger, and how the gobblers caught him, and I tried to rescue him, and it went wrong, and Lord Asriel killed him. Well, I saw him. In my dream, I saw him again. Only he was dead. He was a ghost, and he was, like, beckoning to me, calling to me. Only I couldn't hear. He didn't want me to be dead. It wasn't that. He wanted to speak to me. And it was me that took him there, to Svalbard, where he got killed. It was my fault he was dead. And I thought back to when we used to play in Jordan College, Roger and me, on the roof, all through the town, in the markets, and by the river and down the clay beds, me and Roger and all the others. And I went to Bolvanger to fetch him safe home. Only I made it worse. And if I don't say sorry, it'll all be no good, just a huge waste of time. I got to do that, you see, Will. I got to go down into the land of the dead and find him, and say sorry. I don't care what happens after that. Then we can... I can... Well, it doesn't matter after that.
This place where the dead are, is it a world like this one, like mine, or yours, or any of the others? Is it a world I could get to with the knife?
She looked at him, struck by the idea.
You could ask. Do it now. Ask where it is and how we get there.
She bent over the alethiometer and her fingers moved swiftly. A minute later she had the answer.
Yes, but it's a strange place, Will. So strange. Could we really do that? Could we really go to the land of the dead? But what part of us does that? Because demons fade away when we die. I've seen them. And our bodies, well, they just stay in the grave and decay, don't they?
Then there must be a third part. A different part.
You know, I think that must be true. Because I can think about my body and I can think about my demon. So there must be another part to do the thinking.
Yes. And that's the ghost.
Lyra's eyes blazed.
Maybe we could get Roger's ghost out. Maybe we could rescue him.
Maybe. We could try.
Yeah, we'll do it. We'll go together. That's exactly what we'll do.
But if they didn't get the knife mended, Will thought, they'd be able to do nothing at all. As soon as his head cleared and his stomach felt calmer, he sat up and called to the little spies. They were busy with some minute apparatus nearby.
Who are you? And whose side are you on?
The man finished what he was doing and shut a wooden box like a violin case no longer than a walnut. The woman spoke first.
We are Galavespian. I am the Lady Salmakia, and my companion is the Chevalier Tialis. We are spies for Lord Asriel.
She was standing on a rock 3 or 4 paces away from Will and Lyra, distinct and brilliant in the moonlight. Her little voice was perfectly clear and low, her expression confident. She wore a loose skirt of some silver material and a sleeveless top of green, and her spurred feet were bare like the man's. His costume was similarly coloured, but his sleeves were long and his wide trousers reached to mid-calf. Both of them looked strong, capable, ruthless and proud.
What world do you come from? I never seen people like you before.
Our world has the same problems as yours,
said Thialis.
We are outlaws. Our leader, Lord Roke, heard of Lord Asriel's revolt and pledged our support.
And what did you want to do with me?
To take you to your father,
said the Lady Salmakia.
Lord Asriel sent a force under King Ogunwe to rescue you and the boy and bring you both to his fortress. We are here to help.
Ah, but suppose I don't want to go to my father? Suppose I don't trust him?
I'm sorry to hear that, but those are our orders, to take you to him.
Lyra couldn't help it. She laughed out loud at the notion of these tiny people making her do anything. But it was a mistake. Moving suddenly, the woman seized Pantalaimon, and holding his mouse body in a fierce grip, she touched the tip of a spur to his leg. Lyra gasped. It was like the shock when the men at Bolvanger had seized him. No one should touch someone else's demon. It was a violation. But then she saw that Will had swept up the man in his right hand, holding him tightly around the leg so he couldn't use his spurs, and was holding him high.
Stalemate again. Put the Chevalier down, boy.
Let go of Lyra's demon first. I'm not in the mood to argue.
Lyra saw with a cold thrill that Will was perfectly ready to dash the Galivespian's head against the rock, and both little people knew it. Salmakia lifted her foot away from Pantalaimon's leg, and at once he fought free of her grasp and changed into a wildcat, hissing ferociously, fur on end, tail lashing. His bared teeth were a hand's breadth from the lady's face, and she gazed at him with perfect composure. After a moment he turned and fled to Lyra's breast, ermine-shaped, and Will carefully placed Thialis back on the rock beside his partner.
You should show some respect,
the Chevalier said to Lyra.
You are a thoughtless, insolent child, and several brave men have died this evening in order to make you safe. You'd do better to act politely.
Yes, I'm sorry, I will. Honest.
As for you...
As for me, I'm not going to be spoken to like that, so don't try. Respect goes two ways. Now listen carefully. You are not in charge here. We are. If you want to stay and help, then you do as we say. Otherwise, go back to Lord Asriel now. There's no arguing about it.
Lyra could see the pair of them bristling, but Thialis was looking at Will's hand, which was on the sheath at his belt, and she knew he was thinking that while Will had the knife, he was stronger than they were. At all costs, they mustn't know it was broken then.
Very well. We shall help you, because that's the task we've been given. But you must let us know what you intend to do.
That's fair. I'll tell you. We're going back into Lyra's world as soon as we've rested, and we're going to find a friend of ours, a bear. He's not far away.
The bear with the armor? Very well. We saw him fight. We'll help you do that. But then you must come with us to Lord Asriel.
Yes,
said Lyra, lying earnestly.
Oh, yes. We'll do that then, all right.
Pantalaimon was calmer now and curious, so she let him climb to her shoulder and change. He became a dragonfly, as big as the two that were skimming through the air as they spoke, and darted up to join them.
That poison,
Lyra said, turning back to the Galivespians.
In your spurs, I mean. Is it deadly? Because you stung my mother, Mrs. Coulter, didn't you? Will she die?
It was only a light sting,
said Thialis.
A full dose would have killed her, yes, but a small scratch will make her weak and drowsy for half a day or so.
And full of maddening pain, he knew. But he didn't tell her that.
I need to talk to Lyra in private. We're just going to move away for a minute.
With that knife, you can cut through from one world to another. Isn't that so?
Don't you trust me?
No.
All right. I'll leave it here, then. If I haven't got it, I can't use it.
He unbuckled the sheath and laid it on the rock, and then he and Lyra walked away and sat where they could see the Galivespians. Thialis was looking closely at the knife handle, but he wasn't touching it.
We'll just have to put up with them. As soon as the knife's mended, we'll escape.
They're so quick, Will. And they wouldn't care. They'd kill you.
I just hope Yorick can mend it. I hadn't realized how much we need it.
He will.
She was watching Pantalaimon as he skimmed and darted through the air, snapping up tiny moths like the other dragonflies. He couldn't go as far as they could, but he was just as fast, and even more brightly patterned. She raised her hand and he settled on it, his long, transparent wings vibrating.
Do you think we can trust them while we sleep?
Will said.
Yes, they're fierce, but I think they're honest.
They went back to the rock, and Will said to the Gallivespians,
I'm going to sleep now. We'll move on in the morning.
The Chevalier nodded, and Will curled up at once and fell asleep. Lyra sat down beside him with Pantalaimon cat-formed and warm in her lap. How lucky Will was that she was awake now to look after him. He was truly fearless, and she admired that beyond measure. But he wasn't good at lying and betraying and cheating, which all came to her as naturally as breathing. When she thought of that, she felt warm and virtuous, because she did it for Will, never for herself. She had intended to look at the alethiometer again, but to her deep surprise she found herself as weary as if she'd been awake all that time instead of unconscious. And she lay down close by and closed her eyes, just for a brief nap, as she assured herself before she fell asleep. Chapter 14. Know What It Is.
Labor without joy is base. Labor without sorrow is base. Sorrow without labor is base. Joy without labor is base. John Ruskin.
Will and Lyra slept through the night and woke up when the sun struck their eyelids. They actually awoke within seconds of each other with the same thought, but when they looked around, the Chevalier Tialis was calmly on guard close by.
The force of the consistorial court has retreated. Mrs. Coulter is in the hands of King Ogunwe, and on her way to Lord Asriel.
How do you know?
Said Will, sitting up stiffly.
Have you been back through the window?
No. We talk through the lodestone resonator. I reported our conversation,
Tialis said to Lyra,
to my commander, Lord Roke, and he has agreed that we should go with you to the bear, and that once you have seen him, you will come with us. So, we are allies, and we shall help you as much as we can.
Good. Then let's eat together. Do you eat our food?
Thank you, yes,
said the lady. Will took out his last few dried peaches and the stale flat loaf of rye bread, which was all he had left, and shared it among them, though of course the spies did not take much.
As for water, there doesn't seem to be any around here on this world. We'll have to wait till we go back through before we can have a drink.
Then we better do that soon,
said Lyra. First, though, she took out the alethiometer and asked if there was still any danger in the valley. No, came the answer. All the soldiers have gone, and the villagers are in their homes. So they prepared to leave. The window looked strange in the dazzling air of the desert, giving on to the deep shaded bush, a square of thick green vegetation hanging in the air like a painting. The Gallivespians wanted to look at it, and were astounded to see how it was just not there from the back, and how it only sprang into being when you came round from the side.
I'll have to close it once we're through,
Will said. Lyra tried to pinch the edges together after they went through, but her fingers couldn't find it at all. Nor could the spies, despite the fineness of their hands. Only Will could feel exactly where the edges were, and he did it cleanly and quickly.
How many worlds can you enter with the knife?
As many as there are. No one would ever have time to find out.
He swung his rucksack up and led the way along the forest path. The dragonflies relished the fresh, moist air and darted like needles through the shafts of sunlight. The movement of the trees above was less violent, and the air was cool and tranquil, so it was all the more shocking to see the twisted wreckage of a gyropter suspended among the branches, with the body of its African pilot tangled in his seatbelt, half out of the door, and to find the charred remains of the Zeppelin a little farther up, soot-black strips of cloth, blackened struts and pipework, broken glass, and then the bodies. Three men burned to cinders, their limbs contorted and drawn up as if they were still threatening to fight. And they were only the ones who had fallen near the path. There were other bodies and more wreckage on the cliff above and among the trees further down. Shocked and silenced, the two children moved through the carnage, while the spies on their dragonflies looked around more coolly, accustomed to battle, noting how it had gone and who had lost most. When they reached the top of the valley, where the trees thinned out and the rainbow waterfalls began, they stopped to drink deeply of the ice-cold water.
I hope that little girl's all right. We'd never have got you away if she hadn't woken you up. She went to a holy man to get that powder specially.
She is all right, 'cause I asked the alethiometer last night. She thinks we're devils, though. She's afraid of us. She probably wishes she'd never got mixed up in it. But she's safe all right.
They climbed up beside the waterfalls and refilled Will's canteen, before striking off across the plateau towards the ridge where the alethiometer told Lyra that Yorick had gone. And then there came a day of long, hard walking. No trouble for Will, but a torment to Lyra, whose limbs were weakened and softened after her long sleep. But she would sooner have her tongue torn out than confess how bad she felt. Limping, tight-lipped, trembling, she kept pace with Will and said nothing. Only when they sat down at noon did she allow herself so much as a whimper, and then only when Will had gone apart to relieve himself. The Lady Salmakia said,
"Rest. There is no disgrace in being weary."
"But I don't want to let Will down. I don't want him to think I'm weak and holding him back."
"That's the last thing he thinks."
"You don't know. You don't know him any more than you know me."
"I know impertinence when I hear it. Do as I tell you now and rest. Save your energy for the walking."
Lyra felt mutinous, but the lady's glittering spurs were very clear in the sunlight, so she said nothing. The lady's companion, the Chevalier, was opening the case of the lodestone resonator, and, curiosity overcoming resentment, Lyra watched to see what he did. The instrument looked like a short length of pencil made of dull grey-black stone, resting on a stand of wood, and the Chevalier swept a tiny bow like a violinist's across the end, while he pressed his fingers at various points along the surface. The places weren't marked, so he seemed to be touching it at random, but from the intensity of his expression and the certain fluency of his movements, Lyra knew it was as skillful and demanding a process as her own reading of the alethiometer. After several minutes, the spy put the bow away and took up a pair of headphones, the earpieces no larger than Lyra's little fingernail, and wrapped one end of the wire tightly around a peg in the end of the stone, leading the rest along to another peg at the other end, and wrapping it around that. By manipulating the two pegs and the tension on the wire between them, he could obviously hear a response to his own message.
"How does that work?"
she said when he'd finished. Tialis looked at her as if to judge whether she was genuinely interested, and then said,
"Your scientists, what do you call them, experimental theologians, would know of something called quantum entanglement. It means that two particles can exist that only have properties in common, so that whatever happens to one happens to the other at the same moment, no matter how far apart they are. Well, in our world, there is a way of taking a common lodestone and entangling all its particles and then splitting it in two, so that both parts resonate together. The counterpart to this is with Lord Roke, our commander. When I play on this one with my bow, the other one reproduces the sounds exactly. And so we communicate."
He put everything away and said something to the lady. She joined him and they went a little apart, talking too quietly for Lyra to hear, though Pantalaimon became an owl and turned his great ears in their direction. Presently Will came back and then they moved on, more slowly as the day went by and the track got steeper and the snow line nearer. They rested once more at the head of a rocky valley, because even Will could tell that Lyra was nearly finished. She was limping badly and her face was grey.
"Let me see your feet,"
he said to her,
"because if they're blistered, I'll put some ointment on."
They were, badly, and she let him rub in the blood moss salve, closing her eyes and gritting her teeth. Meanwhile, the Chevalier was busy, and after a few minutes he put his lodestone away and said,
"I have told Lord Roke of our position, and they are sending a gyropter to bring us away as soon as you have spoken to your friend."
Will nodded. Lyra took no notice. Presently she sat up wearily and pulled on her socks and shoes, and they set off once more. Another hour, and most of the valley was in shadow, and Will was wondering whether they would find any shelter before night fell. But then Lyra gave a cry of relief and joy.
"Yorick! Yorick!"
She had seen him before Will had. The Bear King was some way off still, his white coat indistinct against a patch of snow, but when Lyra's voice echoed out he turned his head, raised it to sniff, and bounded down the mountainside towards them. Ignoring Will, he let Lyra clasp his neck and bury her face in his fur, growling so deep that Will felt it through his feet. But Lyra felt it as pleasure and forgot her blisters and her weariness in a moment.
"Oh, Yorick, my dear, I'm so glad to see you. I never thought I'd ever see you again, after that time on Svalbard. And all the things that have happened. Is Mr. Scoresby safe? How's your kingdom? Are you all alone here?"
The little spies had vanished. At all events, there seemed to be only the three of them now on the darkening mountainside, the boy and the girl and the great white bear. As if she had never wanted to be anywhere else, Lyra climbed up as Yorick offered his back, and rode proud and happy as her dear friend carried her up the last stretch of the way to his cave. Will, preoccupied, didn't listen as Lyra talked to Yorick, though he did hear a cry of dismay at one point and heard her say,
"Mr. Scoresby! Oh, no! Oh, it's too cruel! Really dead. You're sure, Yorick?"
"The witch told me he set out to find the man called Grumman."
Will listened more closely now, for Baruch and Balthamos had told him some of this.
"What happened? Who killed him?"
"He died fighting. He kept a whole company of Muscovites at bay while the man escaped. I found his body. He died bravely. I shall avenge him."
Lyra was weeping freely, and Will didn't know what to say, for it was his father whom this unknown man had died to save. And Lyra and the bear had both known and loved Lee Scoresby, and he had not. Soon Yorick turned aside and made for the entrance to a cave, very dark against the snow. Will didn't know where the spies were, but he was perfectly sure they were nearby. He wanted to speak quietly to Lyra, but not till he could see the Gallivespians and know he wasn't being overheard. He laid his rucksack in the cave mouth and sat down wearily. Behind him the bear was kindling a fire, and Lyra watched, curious despite her sorrow. Yorick held a small rock of some sort of ironstone in his left forepaw, and struck it no more than 3 or 4 times on a similar one on the floor. Each time a scatter of sparks burst out and went exactly where Yorick directed them, into a heap of shredded twigs and dried grass. Very soon that was ablaze, and Yorick calmly placed one log and then another and another until the fire was burning strongly. The children welcomed it, because the air was very cold now. And then came something even better, a haunch of something that might have been goat. Yorick ate his meat raw, of course, but he spitted its joint on a sharp stick and laid it to roast across the fire for the two of them.
"Is it easy, hunting up in these mountains, Yorick?"
"No, my people can't live here. I was wrong, but luckily so, since I found you. What are your plans now?"
Will looked around the cave. They were sitting close to the fire, and the firelight threw warm yellows and oranges on the Bear King's fur. Will could see no sign of the spies, but there was nothing for it. He had to ask.
"King Yorick, my knife is broken."
Then he looked past the bear and said,
"No, wait."
He was pointing at the wall.
"If you're listening, come out and do it honestly. Don't spy on us."
Lyra and Yorick Birnison turned to see who he was talking to. The little man came out of the shadow and stood calmly in the light on a ledge higher than the children's heads. Yorick growled.
"You haven't asked Yorick Birnison for permission to enter his cave. And he is a king and you're just a spy. You should show more respect."
Lyra loved hearing that. She looked at Will with pleasure and saw him fierce and contemptuous. But the Chevalier's expression as he looked at Will was displeased.
"We have been truthful with you. It was dishonorable to deceive us."
Will stood up. His demon, Lyra thought, would have the form of a tigress, and she shrank back from the anger she imagined the great animal to show.
"If we deceived you, it was necessary. Would you have agreed to come here if you knew the knife was broken? Of course you wouldn't. You'd have used your venom to make us unconscious, and then you'd have called for help and had us kidnapped and taken to Lord Asriel. So we had to trick you, Tialis, and you'll just have to put up with it."
"Who is this?"
"Spies, sent by Lord Asriel. They helped us escape yesterday, but if they're on our side, they shouldn't hide and eavesdrop on us. And if they do, they're the last people who should talk about dishonor."
The spy's glare was so ferocious that he looked ready to take on Yorick himself, never mind the unarmed Will. But Tialis was in the wrong, and he knew it. All he could do was bow and apologize.
"Your Majesty,"
he said to Yorick, who growled at once. The Chevalier's eyes flashed hatred at Will, and defiance and warning at Lyra, and a cold and wary respect at Yorick. The clarity of his features made all these expressions vivid and bright, as if a light shone on him. Beside him, the Lady Salmakia was emerging from the shadow, and, ignoring the children completely, she made a curtsy to the bear.
"Forgive us,"
she said to Yorick.
"The habit of concealment is hard to break, and my companion, the Chevalier Tialis, and I, the Lady Salmakia, have been among our enemies for so long that, out of pure habit, we neglected to pay you the proper courtesy." We're accompanying this boy and girl to make sure they arrive safely in the care of Lord Asriel. We have no other aim, and certainly no harmful intention towards you, King Yorick Bjernason.
If Yorick wondered how any such tiny beings could cause him harm, he didn't show it. Not only was his expression naturally hard to read, but he had his courtesy too, and the lady had spoken graciously enough.
Come down by the fire. There is food enough and plenty if you are hungry. Will, you began to speak about the knife.
Yes, and I thought it could never happen. But it's broken. And the alethiometer told Lyra that you'd be able to mend it. I was going to ask more politely, but there it is. Can you mend it, Yorick?
Show me.
Will shook all the pieces out of the sheath and laid them on the rocky floor, pushing them about carefully until they were in their right places, and he could see that they were all there. Lyra held a burning branch up, and in its light Yorick bent low to look closely at each piece, touching it delicately with his massive claws and lifting it up to turn it this way and that and examine the break. Will marveled at the deftness in those huge black hooks. Then Yorick sat up again, his head rearing high into the shadow.
Yes,
he said, answering exactly the question and no more. Lyra said, knowing what he meant.
But will you, Yorick? You couldn't believe how important this is. If we can't get it mended, then we're in desperate trouble. And not only us.
I don't like that knife. I fear what it can do. I have never known anything so dangerous. The most deadly fighting machines are little toys compared to that knife. The harm it can do is unlimited. It would have been infinitely better if it had never been made.
But with it...
With it, you can do strange things. What you don't know is what the knife does on its own. Your intentions may be good. The knife has intentions, too.
How can that be?
The intentions of a tool are what it does. A hammer intends to strike. A vice intends to hold fast. A lever intends to lift. They are what it is made for. But sometimes a tool may have other uses that you don't know. Sometimes in doing what you intend, you also do what the knife intends, without knowing. Can you see the sharpest edge of that knife?
No,
said Will, for it was true. The edge diminished to a thinness so fine that the eye could not reach it.
Then how can you know everything it does?
I can't. But I must still use it and do what I can to help good things come about. If I did nothing, I'd be worse than useless. I'd be guilty.
Lyra was following this closely, and seeing Yorick still unwilling, she said,
Yorick, you know how wicked those Bolvanger people were. If we can't win, then they're going to be able to carry on doing those kind of things forever. And besides, if we don't have the knife, then they might get hold of it themselves. We never knew about it when I first met you, Yorick, and nor did anyone. But now that we do, we got to use it ourselves. We can't just not. That'd be feeble, and it'd be wrong, too. It'd be just like handing it over to him and saying, Go on, use it. We won't stop you. All right, we don't know what it does. But I can ask the alethiometer, can't I? Then we'd know, and we could think about it properly, instead of just guessing and being afraid.
Will didn't want to mention his own most pressing reason. If the knife was not repaired, he might never get home, never see his mother again. She would never know what had happened. She'd think he'd abandoned her as his father had done. The knife would have been directly responsible for both their desertions. He must use it to return to her, or never forgive himself. Yorick Bjernason said nothing for a long time, but turned his head to look out at the darkness. Then he slowly got to his feet and stalked to the cave mouth and looked up at the stars, some the same as those he knew from the north, and some that were strange to him. Behind him, Lyra turned the meat over on the fire, and Will looked at his wounds to see how they were healing. Tialis and Salmakia sat silent on their ledge. Then Yorick turned around.
Very well. I shall do it on one condition, though I feel it is a mistake. My people have no gods, no ghosts or demons. We live and die, and that is that. Human affairs bring us nothing but sorrow and trouble. But we have language, and we make war, and we use tools. Maybe we should take sides. But full knowledge is better than half knowledge. Lyra, read your instrument. Know what it is that you're asking. If you still want it, then I shall mend the knife.
At once, Lyra took out the alethiometer and edged nearer to the fire so that she could see the face. The reading took her longer than usual, and when she blinked and sighed and came out of the trance, her face was troubled.
I never known it so confused. There was lots of things it said. I think I got it clear. I think so. It said about balance first. It said the knife could be harmful, or it could do good. But it was so slight, such a delicate kind of a balance, that the faintest thought or wish could tip it one way or the other. And it meant you, Will. It meant what you wished or thought. Only it didn't say what would be a good thought or a bad one. Then it said yes,
she said, her eyes flashing at the spies.
It said yes. Do it. Repair the knife.
Yorick looked at her steadily and then nodded once. Dialis and Salmakia climbed down to watch more closely, and Lyra said,
Do you need more fuel, Yorick? Me and Will could go and fetch some, I'm sure.
Will understood what she meant. Away from the spies, they could talk. Yorick said,
Below the first spur on the track, there is a bush with resinous wood. Bring as much of that as you can.
She jumped up at once, and Will went with her. The moon was brilliant, the path a track of scumbled footprints in the snow, the air cutting and cold. Both of them felt brisk and hopeful and alive. They didn't talk till they were well away from the cave.
What else did it say?
It said some things I didn't understand then, and I still don't understand now. It said the knife would be the death of dust, but then it said it was the only way to keep dust alive. I didn't understand it, Will, but it said again it was dangerous. It kept saying that. It said if we, you know, what I thought.
If we go to the world of the dead.
Yeah. If we do that, it said that we might never come back, Will. We might not survive.
He said nothing, and they walked along more soberly now, watching out for the bush that Yorick had mentioned, and silenced by the thought of what they might be taking on.
We've got to, though, haven't we?
I don't know.
Now we know, I mean. You have to speak to Roger, and I want to speak to my father. We have to now.
I'm frightened.
And he knew she'd never admit that to anyone else.
Did it say what would happen if we didn't?
Just emptiness. Just blankness. I really didn't understand it, Will. But I think it meant that even if it is that dangerous, we should still try and rescue Roger. But it won't be like when I rescued him from Bolvanger. I didn't know what I was doing then, really. I just set off and I was lucky. I mean, there was all kinds of other people to help, like the Egyptians and the witches. There won't be any help where we'd have to go. And I can see. In my dream, I saw the place was... It was worse than Bolvanger. That's why I'm afraid.
What I'm afraid of,
said Will, not looking at her at all,
is getting stuck somewhere and never seeing my mother again.
From nowhere, a memory came to him. He was very young, and it was before her troubles began, and he was ill. All night long, it seemed, his mother had sat on his bed in the dark, singing nursery rhymes, telling him stories, and as long as her dear voice was there, he knew he was safe. He couldn't abandon her now. He couldn't. He'd look after her all his life long if she needed it. And as if Lyra had known what he was thinking, she said,
Yeah, that's true. That would be awful. You know, with my mother, I never realized. I just grew up on my own, really. I don't remember anyone ever holding me or cuddling me. It was just me and Pan as far back as I can go. I can't remember Mrs. Lonsdale being like that to me. She was the housekeeper at Jordan College. All she did was make sure I was clean. That's all she thought about. Oh, and manners. But in the cave, Will, I really felt... Oh, it's strange. I know she's done terrible things, but I really felt she was loving me and looking after me. She must have thought I was going to die being asleep all that time. I suppose I must have caught some disease, but she never stopped looking after me. And I remember waking up once or twice, and she was holding me in her arms. I do remember that, I'm sure. That's what I'd do in her place, if I had a child.
So she didn't know why she'd been asleep all that time. Should he tell her and betray that memory, even if it was false? No, of course he shouldn't.
Is that the bush?
The moonlight was brilliant enough to show every leaf. Will snapped off a twig, and the piney, resinous smell stayed strongly on his fingers.
And we ain't going to say anything to those little spies.
They gathered armfuls of the bush and carried them back up towards the cave. Chapter 15. The Forge.
As I was walking among the fires of hell, delighted with the enjoyments of genius. William Blake.
At that moment, the Gallivespians, too, were talking about the knife. Having made a suspicious peace with Yorick Birnison, they climbed back to their ledge to be out of the way, and as the crackle of flames rose and the snapping and roaring of the fire filled the air, Tialis said,
"We must never leave his side. As soon as the knife is mended, we must keep closer than a shadow."
"He is too alert. He watches everywhere for us,"
said Salmakia.
"The girl is more trusting. I think we could win her around. She's innocent and she loves easily. We could work on her. I think we should do that, Tialis."
"But he has the knife. He is the one who can use it."
"He won't go anywhere without her."
"But she has to follow him if he has the knife. And I think that as soon as the knife's intact again, they'll use it to slip into another world so as to get away from us. Did you see how he stopped her from speaking when she was going to say something more? They have some secret purpose, and it's very different from what we want them to do."
"We'll see. But you're right, Tialis, I think. We must stay close to the boy at all costs."
They both watched with some skepticism as Yorick Birnison laid out the tools in his improvised workshop. The mighty workers in the ordnance factories under Lord Asriel's fortress, with their blast furnaces and rolling mills, their anbaric forges and hydraulic presses, would have laughed at the open fire, the stone hammer, the anvil consisting of a piece of Yorick's armor. Nevertheless, the bear had taken the measure of the task, and in the certainty of his movements, the little spies began to see some quality that muffled their scorn. When Lyra and Will came in with the bushes, Yorick directed them in placing branches carefully on the fire. He looked at each branch, turning it from side to side, and then told Will or Lyra to place it at such and such an angle, or to break off part and place it separately at the edge. The result was a fire of extraordinary ferocity, with all its energy concentrated at one side. By this time the heat in the cave was intense. Yorick continued to build the fire, and made the children take two more trips down the path to ensure that there was enough fuel for the whole operation. Then the bear turned over a small stone on the floor, and told Lyra to find some more stones of the same kind. He said that those stones, when heated, gave off a gas that would surround the blade and keep the air from it, for if the hot metal came in contact with the air, it would absorb some and be weakened by it. Lyra set about searching, and with owl-eyed Pantalaimon's help soon had a dozen or more stones to hand. Yorick told her how to place them, and where, and showed her exactly the kind of draft she should get moving with a leafy branch to make sure the gas flowed evenly over the workpiece. Will was placed in charge of the fire, and Yorick spent several minutes directing him and making sure he understood the principles he was to use. So much depended on exact placement, and Yorick could not stop and correct each one. Will had to understand, and then he'd do it properly. Furthermore, he mustn't expect the knife to look exactly the same when it was mended. It would be shorter, because each section of the blade would have to overlap the next by a little way so they could be forged together, and the surface would have oxidized a little despite the stone gas, so some of the play of color would be lost. And no doubt the handle would be charred, but the blade would be just as sharp, and it would work. So Will watched as the flames roared along the resinous twigs, and with streaming eyes and scorched hands he adjusted each fresh branch till the heat was focused, as Yorick wanted it. Meanwhile, Yorick himself was grinding and hammering a fist-sized stone, having rejected several until he found one of the right weight. With massive blows he shaped it and smoothed it, the cordite smell of smashed rocks joining the smoke in the nostrils of the two spies, watching from high up. Even Pantalaimon was active, changing to a crow so he could flap his wings and make the fire burn faster. Eventually the hammer was formed to Yorick's satisfaction, and he set the first two pieces of the blade of the subtle knife among the fierce burning wood at the heart of the fire, and told Lyra to begin wafting the stone gas over them. The bear watched, his long white face lurid in the glare, and Will saw the surface of the metal begin to glow red, and then yellow, and then white. Yorick was watching closely, his paw held ready to snatch the pieces out. After a few moments the metal changed again, and the surface became shiny and glistening, and sparks just like those from a firework sprayed up from it. Then Yorick moved. His right paw darted in and seized first one piece and then the other, holding them between the tips of his massive claws and placing them on the slab of iron that was the backplate of his armor. Will could smell the claws burning, but Yorick took no notice of that, and moving with extraordinary speed, he adjusted the angle at which the pieces overlapped, and then raised his left paw high and struck a blow with the rock hammer. The knife tip leapt on the rock under the massive blow. Will was thinking that the whole of the rest of his life depended on what happened in that tiny triangle of metal, that point that searched out the gaps inside the atoms, and all his nerves trembled, sensing every flicker of every flame and the loosening of every atom in the lattice of the metal. Before this began, he had supposed that only a full-scale furnace with the finest tools and equipment could work on that blade. But now he saw that these were the finest tools, and that Yorick's artistry had constructed the best furnace there could be. Yorick roared above the clangor,
"Hold it still in your mind! You have to forge it, too! This is your task as much as mine!"
Will felt his whole being quiver under the blows of the stone hammer in the bear's fist. The second piece of the blade was heating, too, and Lyra's leafy branch sent the hot gas along to bathe both pieces in its flow and keep out the iron-eating air. Will sensed it all and felt the atoms of the metal linking each to each across the fracture, forming new crystals again, strengthening and straightening themselves in the invisible lattice as the join came good.
"The edge!"
roared Yorick.
"Hold the edge in line!"
He meant, with your mind, and Will did it instantly, sensing the minute snags and then the minute easement as the edges lined up perfectly. Then that join was made, and Yorick turned to the next piece.
"A new stone!"
he called to Lyra, who knocked the first one aside and placed a second on the spot to heat. Will checked the fuel and snapped a branch in two to direct the flames better, and Yorick began to work with the hammer once more. Will felt a new layer of complexity added to his task, because he had to hold the new piece in a precise relationship with both the previous two, and he understood that only by doing that accurately could he help Yorick mend it. So the work continued. He had no idea how long it took. Lyra, for her part, found her arms aching, her eyes streaming, her skin scorched and red, and every bone in her body aching with fatigue. But still she placed each stone as Yorick had told her, and still the weary Pantalaimon raised his wings readily and beat them over the flames. When it came to the final join, Will's head was ringing, and he was so exhausted by the intellectual effort he could barely lift the next branch onto the fire. He had to understand every connection, or the knife would not hold together. And when it came to the most complex one, the last, which would have fixed the nearly finished blade onto the small part remaining at the handle, if he couldn't hold it in his full consciousness together with all the others, then the knife would simply fall apart as if Yorick had never begun. The bear sensed this too and paused before he began heating the last piece. He looked at Will, and in his eyes Will could see nothing, no expression, just a bottomless black brilliance. Nevertheless, he understood. This was work, and it was hard, but they were equal to it, all of them. That was enough for Will, so he turned back to the fire and sent his imagination out to the broken end.